Okay, I'm back on the phone with Cameron. This is our second day. We did two parts in the first day a couple of days ago, and this is Monday, June 13th, 2016. And we're going to pick up on Cameron's most recent writings on relativity, Einstein, and topology, and other related themes. So I would begin with, as I read the more recent articles, if you look on Cameron's website, McLuhan's New Sciences. Is it New Media Sciences? What is it, New Media?
No.
New Sciences.
It's New Sciences.
Right. I read the last, I don't know, seven articles. And so reading about Siegfried Gideon, are you aware that McLuhan met Wyndham Lewis and Siegfried Gideon in the same year, 1943?
Yes.
Okay, good. You've noticed that. Do you know what time of year he met Siegfried Gideon?
It must have been in the spring.
So that's before Wyndham Lewis, because I think Lewis is in July when he goes up for the talk in Windsor that his mother pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you go by the letters, you can pin it into the summer. Okay, but it's interesting that he meets them in the same year. So just wanted to mention that. Another point.
And he, Bob, I should point out that he brings the two of them together. I'm trying to think exactly where, but.
You mean he introduces them?
No. He in a letter, I think it's to Walter Ong.
Yeah.
But in the middle 1940s, must have been 44, 45, 46, somewhere in there. He writes to Ong and maybe to McNasby at the same time, and he says that something about the Catholic Church needing to have the conceptual tools that are to be found in time and Western man and space, time, and architecture. So he brings the two of them together in that one clause.
Well, that's important. I have to find that. Okay, so remember what he said when he was 19 in his diary around 19? He says, I think there are some laws latent in advertising or something. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What do you make of that statement? Do you think that's only in retrospective looks pretty prophetic for himself, or it's an act of genius what he says?
Well, I think that there's something of both of those, but for me the important thing is that somebody who puts the kind of energy that McLuhan did into thinking over so many years, they need to have a kind of vocation. And I see those sorts of things not as specifying some, you know, possible discovery or something, but as markers of a setting out on a path.
Now, would he have had Lodge or the other guy, what's the other guy's name?
Wright.
Wright. Yeah, I keep thinking of White. Wright. Did he have them in when he's 19 or 20 or junior, senior college years?
I don't know the answer to that. I wish I've contacted the University of Manitoba to find out what kind of information is available about courses that people took. And they don't really know themselves, as far as I can see.
Right.
Because the privacy regulations are so complex, and nobody wants to make a decision. So to me, that's a very important question, not only about McLuhan, but about Hayakawa.
Yes.
We know something about that in terms of for W.O. Mitchell, but then in terms of Goffman. All of these people are concerned with issues that Wright and Lodge themselves were concerned about, And what I need to do is try to figure out just what courses they took and when.
Okay.
We know that Wright and Lodge used their own books as textbooks in their courses, number one. And we know that Wright's book, I forget at the moment exactly what it's called, something like Moral Standards of Democracy or something like that,
yes,
from 1925. We know that not only did McLuhan read that book, but it's marked as heavily annotated in the catalog for his library at Fisher.
Did you go to Toronto to see that?
No, I just, it's the list of books that they have,
yes,
online tells whether or not the book is annotated or not, and if it's annotated, then it's either lightly annotated or heavily annotated.
Yes, I've been at the library, and I've looked through that index, and you're right. So you haven't looked at it. You just know it's heavily annotated because they tell you that, but you haven't seen it.
Correct. But I also know if you look at the posts concerning Wright in my blog, you'll see that some of the things that are in that book are things that obsessed McLuhan for the next 50 years.
Yeah, because you've read the book.
Yes.
I see, yes, so you can see the themes. A side note, I've been doing this series of dialogues with Brian Taylor, who's a young student of McLuhan up in Toronto, and he goes to the Fort Book Library, Thomas Fisher Rare Book, and he'll bring down some McLuhan books, he'll go through the annotations and make notes, and then come on my radio show and we'll discuss it. You might want to listen to some of those things we've done over the past year or so, but
sure.
I can get him to go look for those Wright or Lodge books, and he will write down interesting annotations. You know, we can find out.
Yeah, good. Well, I wish he'd put those online, and if he doesn't have the means of putting them online, I can help him. I can supply some sort of electronic notebook that.
He could do that.
Yeah, so that would be very good. I've asked people in Toronto to do things like that periodically, and but it's
nobody's done it. Nobody's done it.
No, it's not. No, I've had some success, but the problem is Toronto being Toronto. Asking somebody, if they're not actually on the campus, asking somebody to go, to park,
yes,
to do this stuff is kind of difficult, and I don't like to ask people to do that. So if somebody's actually there and is already doing it, that would be, that's cool. There's a lot of stuff there that's important.
Yeah, no, that'd be a good supplement to your blog. Yeah, I'll talk to Brian about it. Can get there easily. He lives downtown, so it's not a problem. The other thing is that when I met Bob Logan in 2014 at one point, either he or an associate of him told me that he's got a team of students or young people going through and writing out the annotations of every book. Have you heard about that?
No, it's but it's a little it's a parallel to what was done for Coleridge at University of Toronto.
Oh yeah.
Coleridge annotated hundreds or thousands of books, and Catherine—I can never remember if it's Catherine Coburn or Kathleen Coburn—but Professor Coburn, now dead, in the English department, headed a team that has rewritten all of the annotations for the Princeton Collected Edition.
Oh, I see. So the books aren't at the University of Toronto. They're in Princeton.
No, Coleridge's books themselves are in different locations. Some of them are at Toronto, actually.
So she had students that go to the different places.
Well, not just students, but professors. I mean, they, Coleridge Research, for the last 50 years, has sort of centered on the Bollingen edition of Coleridge.
Okay. All right. So the next point is, when he talks about in something he wrote in the 40s, you quoted, maybe he's saying it to Innes, but he may have said it earlier, the role of anthropology and social psychology is more important than Thomism. Remember,
right.
Remember
been,
that?
That's in a letter to Ong and McNasby. And it's possible that that's the same letter that where he mentions Gideon and Lewis in the same clause.
So that's the mid-40s. That's not the letter to Innes.
No, that's a letter at the end of 1944, I believe.
Right. Okay. Do you know that Marshall wrote in some article in the 70s, I don't think I have it or I couldn't find it, but I read it once, he says that he is not intrigued or inspired by Chesterton as he was in many decades before. Have you ever read that sentence?
It rings a bell.
Yeah.
It rings a bell, but I remember it as being in secondary literature from somebody quoting a letter.
Yes. It's not in the essay Formal Causality in Chesterton, which comes out in the mid-70s. It's not in there. It's somewhere
right.
else. And then the way he confronted the Thomas on campus, anecdotally, apparently he would scold them for not applying Thomas or updating Thomas. Do you take these statements as there was some inadequacy in Thomism that he realized maybe in the 60s and 70s? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, well, I don't need to think about that. McLuhan didn't know a hell of a lot about Thomas.
Right, he does
we
say...
McLuhan does a lot of stuff by smell and by sort of offhand remark. And, that's not very interesting. The only interesting thing there really is he knew that there was a lot in Thomas that if he had another lifetime or another two or three lifetimes, that it would be well worth him doing the necessary work. He knew that the Catholic Church should be reading Thomas in different ways than what it has done over the last century. But I don't think there's too much more to be said about that.
Well, when he says the doctrine of analogical proportionality is the most beautiful, most something metaphysical insight going, is that a general interpretation of Thomism? Or is it just that eternal insight of the covariability of things, which is the term you use,
mm-hmm.
or the figure ground metaphorical nature of perception. Is that what that's referring to, or is there something in Thomism in particular?
No, there's something in Thomism, for sure. There's something in Heraclitus, Plato, Aristotle, et cetera, et cetera, that is also in Thomas, and that is the insight that ontology itself is dynamic and plural, and that access to that dynamic and access to that plurality is the most important thing about human existence.
When Grace Slick of the Jefferson Airplane puts out on the liner notes of some album in the late 60s that I have many selves, when you talk about the plural of ontology, is that what you mean?
Well, the whole question of the plurality of ontology is one of the great questions that has been considered by the greatest minds for thousands of years and literally has no end to be thought, right? But Christianity has tried to think the plurality of ontology in a whole series of different ways. So one of the most important factors in the genesis of the different sects and denominations within Christianity has to do with how to think about the Trinity, how to think about that plurality, how the persons of the Trinity relate to each other, and how that relates to creation, and how that relates to Jesus, et cetera, et cetera. And the same sorts of very complicated and very diverse types of thinking can be found in Judaism and in Islam and in Buddhism, Hinduism, et cetera. So it's a hugely difficult but important question or research program, put it that way.
Right, so it's not just literally claiming you have more than one self. That's the very limited, vulgar way of addressing the issue?
Well, there's a huge difference between if you have a grandmother in a polytheistic society, she might not be required to think any more than there's more than one self up there. But if you have somebody who's doing thoughtful research into the question, then they have to do better than that.
Yeah,
so it all
yeah.
depends on who we're talking about in what context.
Right. Now, did you just say that the doctrine of analogical proportionality is in Plato, in Buddhism, in these other thought systems you just mentioned?
Or yes, I think I would maintain that, but let's not pretend that those words are immediately clear and they mean one thing, and then all of these different disciplines or denominations or whatever we want to call them are hooked into that one thing. It's not like that at all. What analogical proportionality amounts to and what it means and how it relates to human life and all this sort of thing. These are huge questions that great minds have differed on.
Okay, so did we engage the first recorded session the other day in the huge questions?
I'm not sure I understand. Did we get into them, are you saying?
Did we, whatever Socrates or Plato or Aquinas was spelling out when they would write and struggle with these questions, is it really intense and beyond what we were doing in our educated, sophisticated analysis of McLuhan?
A lot of these folks were a hell of a lot smarter than you and me and McLuhan, Bob.
Right.
So
how do we tell they're smarter? How do you tell they were smarter?
Best.
How do you tell they're smarter?
Because you and I and McLuhan are constantly finding in them things that we didn't know. So they are further out on the pathway of thought than we are. We're looking ahead to them, not backwards to them.
All right. Do you have a list of who are the greatest thinkers those recorded?
No, that itself is something that you, it's like the old saw about individual teenager who knows that his father knows nothing, and then when the teenager becomes 30 or 40, he's surprised how much his father has
yeah.
learned in the meantime. As people learn to think in new ways as they mature, you find that people that once were boring are tremendously exciting. So somebody like Aristotle, for example, at least in my experience, when you first read him, it's really tough going. It's
yeah.
just like trying to eat sawdust or something. And then after you, one has gained some experience of life and some experience of thought, you go back, and it's just incredible how electric and how dynamic the guy's thought is, and you wonder, how could I not have just loved this stuff?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so do you see McLuhan a bit of a gadfly? He's a poet. Like, I mean, he's like, you take Wyndham Lewis, Ezra Pound, they're running around interacting with people in London and in Paris and in Italy, and reading and writing and writing and writing reviews and putting on events. And it's slightly, what is it, dilettante-ish, or is slightly overactive, or slightly on the hustle level. Do you see that McLuhan was kind of like that image of the poet in the world of ideas, which was what you could get through the new city called the university after World War II? Do you see McLuhan like going around and seeing what the latest stuff is, you know, keeping up with the New York Times, what's happening in thought, and looking at the books and then making a pattern or fitting into his constant themes? Do you see him as a bit of a, not negative, but a hustler? A street guy, not a scholar, in the stick in the mud sense of scholar.
That's a difficult question, because I think McLuhan came to see scholars as hustlers.
Yes,
and scholars, including himself, up to a certain point.
Yes,
and so then He became a kind of self-conscious hustler after that point, and turned himself into what the people he considered to be hustlers saw him as an arch hustler.
Yes, yeah.
So he saw himself as trying to out-hustle the hustlers.
Was he a democratic person? Interested in whoever approached him and had some interesting concerns, and would he address them generously? No matter.
Not in my experience, and I've read lots of anecdotes that indicate to me that this was quite general. At least in his later career, he would take an instantaneous like or dislike to a person, and if you were on the dislike side, then he would basically dismiss you.
Yes, but if he liked you, he would be generous.
Maybe. I never saw any of that, but maybe. I guess people have reported that, but
well, what about
I personally didn't see that.
Right, but what about the fact that he offered himself up every Monday in the seminars to an open discussion?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, is that opening himself up, or is that doing something that didn't require much effort on his part, but sort of kept a hand in the game as he defined the game?
Right.
I don't know.
Okay. Now, did you attend any of the seminars?
No. Well, not a Monday night seminar. While I was there, there was a seminar in the afternoon with some of his graduate students, and it was that I just thought, if I had to go through this on a regular basis, it would kill me, and I just said, the hell with it, because there was literally nothing going on that was of any interest to me whatsoever.
Right.
It was just people were sucking up to McLuhan, as far as I could see, and they weren't exercising their own mind, and they certainly weren't exercising his mind.
Well, was he doing? He often pointed out that the symposium, the Socrates content in Plato's books, was a theatrical drama. Do you think he was doing theater in that sense in his Monday night seminars?
Sure. It was it was a put on in a whole bunch of different senses, sure.
Okay. So then we come to this phrase, McLuhan's new sciences. Why is it plural, sciences in your title.
Well, I talk about that in the blog. The reason is it's related to something that came up in our last discussion. We were talking about the span of years between 1816 and 2016, so 200 years.
Yes.
And we differed as to where McLuhan might be situated in that span in terms of a new, like the existing span has to do with the founding and expansion of the physical sciences, plural. And the imaginative span over the 200 years has to do with the foundation and expansion of experiential sciences or social sciences,
yes.
Again, plural. And the reason that I use plural in the blog has to do with the parallel between these two spans, that it seems to me inevitable that if McLuhan did in fact do some fundamental work that enables a new sort of rigor in the experiential and social sciences, then there will be not a single science that looks at these questions. There'll be a series of different sciences on the model of, say, chemistry, organic chemistry, biology,
biochemistry,
ecology, ecology, et cetera.
Right.
And that's what interested me in that news conference in 1964, where I can hear something of this development into a plurality of sciences being discussed there.
So when you looked up the you found the Einstein quote that I mentioned. He pairs Joyce to Einstein. There may have been another one, but that's good enough. What had you thought about that point, Joyce versus Einstein? Once I mentioned, you looked it up the next day or a few hours later. Any thoughts about as you read that?
I don't think it's Joyce versus Einstein. He talks in that same passage. He mentions poets, especially landscape poets, taking off from Newton.
Yeah,
and he actually did a fair amount of work on how Newton's optics had a decided influence on later art and poetry in England in the 18th century.
Yeah, no,
so
he did a lot of that.
Yeah, so I think what he's saying with Joyce and Einstein is that Joyce takes off from Einstein in a parallel fashion to the artists and poets that took off from Newton, and he applies just as those artists and poets applied Newton in a way that didn't occur to Newton and didn't interest Newton, so Joyce was applying Einstein in a way that Einstein didn't know about and didn't care about.
Right. So let me read the quote from the third edition of Explorations, 1954, and the article by McLuhan called New Media as Political Forms. So McLuhan says, Siegfried Gideon has given exact procedures for how the modern painter or poet should conduct himself in the company of scientists. Then a colon, and then here's the statement. Adopt and adapt their discoveries to the uses of art. Why leave this, then he asks, why leave this solely to the distortions of the industrialist? Newton revolutionized the techniques of poetry and painting. Joyce encompasses Einstein, but extends his pictographic formula to the entire world of language and consciousness. And I think he says somewhere else that Joyce, back then in the 50s, Joyce dealing with and solving problems that had not occurred to Einstein. That's in the other sentence, and that might be in the interior landscape. Now, isn't this what McLuhan, this is where the statement where criticism is autobiographical, isn't McLuhan describing himself here under the guise of saying it's Joyce?
For my purposes, there's a lot in that passage that needs to be thought through.
Yes.
And one of the major things is the word pictographic.
Yes.
McLuhan at this time is still very much caught up in the kind of Kempis thinking about visuality. And so this is 1954, and he's in the middle of the explorations seminar by this time. And this passage marks the fact that McLuhan himself, at this late date, still has not gotten away from the Gutenberg galaxy. He still thinks that what's going on with Einstein and Joyce is pictographic.
Yes.
And he will decidedly come to criticize that whole notion when he figures out in the next couple of years that acoustic space has nothing to do with a pictograph.
Do you think he, as some people say, he got that from Ted Carpenter? That's the big contribution of, you know, his Eskimo knowledge, anthropological
right.
studies. Do you think that was a big effect on McLuhan? Carpenter's.
Yeah, I'm actually writing a post about this now. I think it came through Carpenter. I think it came through Williams, because Carlton Williams, who McLuhan knew back in Winnipeg, Carlton Williams worked with E.A. Bott, and Bott was in the psychology department at University of Toronto and was interested in acoustic space. So Williams brought that into the seminar.
Yes.
And then at the same time, McLuhan was reading Finnegan's Wake all the time. So I think all of these things played a role in him coming to see that if he were to relativize or apply relativity theory to experience, that he had to learn in his own mind what it means to give up visuality.
Right. I didn't know Carlton Williams was from Winnipeg. That's interesting.
They were the same age. They were at the University of Manitoba at the same time.
They knew each other.
Yeah.
So you've got, there's about five people in the seminar group. So you've got two, you've got Easterbrook, Williams and McLuhan, three of them. This is where you could, you know, this is the Winnipeg School of Communication. And then you have Turritt and Carpenter, or maybe one more person. Is there six? Jackie Turritt and Carpenter, McLuhan, Williams and...
Easterbrook.
Is that
yeah. it? Yeah. So, no, that's the key group right there. Of course, other people were coming and going all the time, but those were the people that were on the application.
Yes.
The Ford Foundation. And it's often said that Williams was included because they wanted to have a different point of view and they wanted to have a balanced application. But I think Williams was in there because he was an old friend of McLuhan's. And remained a good friend of McLuhan's until the end of their days.
It's really fun to think of the Exploration Seminar, which has, in certain circles, you know, a glorious reputation, with three guys from Winnipeg. He's their old buddies.
Yeah. That's right. But not just that they came from Winnipeg, that they were at the University of Manitoba at the same time, taking the same courses. For example, Williams graduated from University of Manitoba in psychology, and psychology at that point was a part of the philosophy department. And if he wanted to concentrate in psychology, he would have done it with Henry Wright.
Right. So what is I don't think we said in the first dialogue, what is the core idea, for those who don't know these people, what is the core idea of right, if there is one?
No, there definitely is. Well, I think he has two core ideas. One is that all human experience is pre-shaped or pre-organized in different fundamental ways. So just as McLuhan will later say that experience can have a visual base, bias or an acoustic bias or perhaps a combination of these, that's a takeoff on what is ultimately a Hegelian typology that right definitely tried to articulate in terms of psychology. So you have that, and then secondly, you have the Wright and Lodge weren't dumb people at all. They were very, very intelligent people, so they realized that if experience is always pre-shaped, then how is our experience of the pre-shapes of experience shaped?
Yes.
Okay? And so they were conscious of the fact that the only way that this could make any sense instead of trailing off into infinity would be if there was a kind of fundamental communication between the types of human experience. Well, Wright talks about what he calls intercommunication as being the key to human identity, to human social life, human religious life, etc. And when McLuhan later encounters what may be called the history of communication in Innes, this immediately rings old bells that he had in his head from Wright.
Yes. Did you say topology, T-O-P-O, or typology about 5 minutes ago? T-Y-P-O. Typology or
sure.
T-O-P-O or T-Y-P-O? Which did you said that Wright laid out the typology, it sounded like, rather than
Oh, yeah. No, I did say typology, yeah.
Yeah, T-Y-P. T-Y.
That's right.
Yes.
But once it's realized that there is some kind of communication between these types, which makes it possible for us to talk about them intelligently, then the typology has a kind of topological dimension that is that communication.
And when you say topological, you have that great metaphor, maybe from Valerie, about the rubber twisting with the symbols
right.
on it, right? That's the, we don't need to repeat that, but that's what you're thinking of. Now, did Hegel lay this out? Did they just repeat Hegel, or were they original, Rupert, Lodge, and Wright?
Wow, I mean, the word original is a very difficult word, but let's just say that very few people in the history of mankind are of Hegel's rank. Hegel is way up there with Plato and Aristotle and Thomas and those sorts of people.
Yeah.
Wright and Lodge were not those kinds of great thinkers, but they were very able thinkers, and they were able to consider questions that had been considered by the very greatest thinkers in ways that were not inappropriate. So I mean, that compares to many academics both then and now that have no capacity to consider these ideas except inappropriately.
Well, who was Wright and Lodge, who were they influenced by? Just Hegel, or were they reading Jung and Freud and sociology and physics? Were they polymaths?
Well, first, Wright was sometime around 1919-1920, Wright was the president of the Western Philosophical Association, and amongst the people that were officers in the Philosophical Association was George Meade, who was in Chicago just like Wright was at the time.
Yes.
So Wright was heavily influenced by the Chicago school that influenced Innes, and that McLuhan, in remarks that have been widely ridiculed, has said that if you want to understand Innes, you have to understand Park.
Robert Chicago.
Park. Sorry?
I was just going to bring up Robert Park. You have to understand Robert Park. That's right.
That's right. So McLuhan says that in one of the introductions he does to one of Innes's books.
Yes.
Forget which one.
Yes.
But what McLuhan is saying there is that the Chicago school, which had a concern for communication, was without having a single central doctrine, was involved in research about communication, about centrality and marginality, that we need to go back, situate ourselves in that research program if we want to understand the sort of thing that Innes did and that I'm doing. And McLuhan, when he was influenced, as he certainly was, by Innes, he was going back to Wright, because Wright brought these same ideas from Chicago to Winnipeg. And his concerns with communication, with margin, I don't think he talks about marginality, but he talks about the relation of human beings to God, say, where there's an implied marginality. So one of his books is called The Religious Response.
Yes.
Which has to do with what is the communication between a limited creature and an unlimited creator. So McLuhan was introduced to ideas of the Chicago School already around 1930 in Winnipeg, but of course, being introduced to an idea, having these things go into your head, has very little to do with what you will eventually make of them, if anything, and how the percolation in the meantime takes place.
I knew about Robert Park, but I wasn't aware of the biography of Wright. I read a little bit you wrote, but I did not notice, and that's incredible, that Innes is studying under Park, and McLuhan's influenced by Park through Wright, and just Wright or Lodge too?
Well, more Wright, because Lodge was an Englishman who had taught in various places, but not in Chicago.
Right.
But Wright and Lodge, they came together to University of Manitoba in 1920, and they decidedly influenced each other.
Yes.
This whole topic is absolutely huge, Bob, and it's amazing how little people know about it.
Nobody knows about it.
Well,
other than you.
Well, maybe. I'm trying to think of the, there's a couple things that I need to remember, and instead of stumbling around about them now, I'll come back to it as we talk. So let's leave that for a second, or at least go to some question of yours about it.
Yes, this is really good to realize I mean, I know he talks about Robert Park in maybe the Queen's Quarterly essay, the early Innes one he does in 53, or maybe
no,
the 19...
It's one of his later introductions.
Well, that's 1964, the Bias of Communication then, or Empire and Communications in 72, but probably
yeah,
64.
I think it's the latest one, so I think it's the 72
okay.
Empire.
All right, so you have Robert Park. Is Talcott Parsons younger than Park? Is he a little later?
Oh, later.
Right. Does he come out of the Chicago school?
No.
Oh, okay.
But all of these people are involved in sort of the birth of sociology, you could say.
Yes. Now, that guy, Bernays, all the conspiracy theorists say that Edward, or whatever his name is, Eugene Bernays, you know, comes out of Freud and is the first Madison Avenue propagandist manipulator. Have you heard of him, Bernays?
I know the name, but I know nothing about him.
Right. Okay. So you can't add any light on where he was in relation to the Chicago School. We'll have to look that up. But you've heard that people make a big deal out of him. Those of the monad view of history, you know, the lone nut guy. You know, the Rockefellers hire him, and he comes up with this great way to mold people's minds, and he gets involved with Freud's daughter, Anna Freud, and so you have this. There's a guy who does these documentaries, British guy, the last 10 or 15 years, and he does a big one on Bernays. So that's something we got to look at. I'm interested in your reaction when you read up a little bit more about Bernays. But now, the other point is, I've read most of the University of Manitoba student paper articles by McLuhan that Jim Patterson found, you know, and posted for us. Do you see the influence of Wright or Lodge in those articles?
Well, I mean, I have all the articles. I've read all the articles. I don't remember thinking about them in that fashion, so I'd have to go back and look. But I do know, for example, in the blog, I mentioned the fact that in his master's thesis on Meredith, McLuhan discusses typology in relation to philosophy and to literature.
That's T-Y-P-O. T-Y.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And that is something that he would have had, on the one hand, from his mother.
Yes.
Because his mother was putting on different types. And on the other hand, had from Lodge and Wright.
Yes. What struck me when I read those articles, the idea of the global village was in there. Maybe, you know, it was well known in the 30s, the internationalist image or philosophy, it was bandied about, and the nationalists didn't like the internationalists. But he talks about, in a couple of paragraphs, about international structure that people are molded by as if it's the global village concept. Do you remember that part?
I don't, actually.
Okay, so that's what I know. That's where I saw him thinking globally, and the industrial infrastructure, or maybe not so much electric communications, but he's talking about an interdependent world and knowing that most specialties were inadequate to that new situation. You might want to take a look back and scan through the articles and find those places where he talks about that. It's pretty interesting, pretty prescient in a way. But he's going to, you have to look up the year he writes that. It could be 32, 31, or 33. He leaves in 33 or 34.
He graduated with his bachelor in 33, but he remained one more year until 34 to get his master's.
Okay, so he's there at 34. yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just clearing my throat.
Oh.
But I may have to take a break for about 10 minutes. If it's possible, one of our dogs is very sick, and I give him medicine around this time.
Okay, you can do that. Let me just mention this thought. When you went to McLuhan's Center in 71, were you, the idea you proposed was for a master's or for a PhD?
That wasn't discussed. I didn't really care.
No, what did you have when you went there in 71 and met McLuhan?
I just had my undergraduate degree.
Oh, so you would have probably had to work on a master's first.
I guess that was a period of time when there was a time prior to that where you had to get your master's before your PhD, and then there was a time after that when the usual thing was you could, if you were to get a master's, you had to be accepted into a PhD program because nobody wanted to have people that were just interested in hanging around for a single year or something.
Right.
And what exactly the thinking was at University of Toronto at that time, I have no idea. And it wasn't any concern of mine then.
One, can you summarize Rupert's main idea? What's different in his work from Wright, even though they're both neo-Hegelians?
I don't know that they would characterize themselves as neo-Hegelians because that is a little bit of a technical term.
Mm.
I would say that much English philosophy prior to the First World War, let's say. The influence of Hegel was pervasive, but there were very sizable distinctions within that pervasive influence. And the type of Hegelianism that Wright and Lodge professed was mediated in Canada and to some extent in the United States through John Watson,
yeah,
who was a longtime professor of philosophy at Queen's.
Not the Watson of behaviorism, someone else.
No.
Yeah.
No. This is, that Watson was at Harvard and he was a behavioralist. And John Watson in Canada was a student of Edward Caird in Scotland, came to Queen's just after Confederation in the early 1870s, I think it was, and was still going strong in the 1920s.
Mm.
So he was there for a hell of a long time, exerted a huge influence on philosophy in Canada. But what is generally not known is that the two main influences on McLuhan and on others in the Winnipeg School of Communication, namely Wright and Lodge, were people that when a festschrift was put together for the 50th anniversary of Watson's career in Canada, of the maybe 10 people that contributed essays, Wright and Lodge were two.
Yes.
So beyond the known influence of Watson on all kinds of thought in Canada, going all the way up to Charles Taylor, what I think is not known, but which is potentially even more important, is that McLuhan and others of the Winnipeg School of Communications were much influenced by Watson through Lodge and Wright.
So what is the core idea of Lodge?
Well, the difference, I would say, between Lodge and Wright is that, first, Wright was much more, well, he headed up psychology within the philosophy department. They were, Wright and Lodge were co-heads of the philosophy department, often taught the same course, with Wright taking the first semester and Lodge the second semester. Both were very interested in the idea that experience is sort of preformed by fundamental types. But Wright was more interested in the psychological side of this, and in the religious side of this, and in the ethical side of this, whereas Lodge was more interested in the logical side of this.
Okay.
So in one of his letters around 1935, McLuhan complains about Lodge being an idealist and abstracted from life, like Plato and Buddhists or something, and he prefers Aristotle and Thomas.
Okay, that's good. Now, let's get into your theme, relativity and topology. You've heard the, maybe it's more of a journalistic level, it's even entered into politics, the neoconservatives don't like cultural relativism, and they want to get back to whatever they think are the basics, which is, you know, props up nationalism or something. Is the argument against cultural relativism or for it part of your use of the word relativity? Is it that issue you're addressing?
No. There's the word relativity, or saying that something is relative or not, has very wide a very wide set of meanings, and when Einstein is talking about relativity, he doesn't mean that the things that are the correlates that are relative to each other. He's not at all saying that that makes them unintelligible or bad or whatever some neoconservative might mean by the term relative.
Cultural relativism. So
yeah, okay. Cultural relativism has nothing to do with Einstein and McLuhan, except that for McLuhan, cultural relativism, namely the idea that values shouldn't play a role in the analysis of experience, and that all conceivable types of culture need to be considered as simultaneous factors in the conceptualization of experience. I worry that I'm getting into a very long sentence here that no one in the world is going to.
No, it's okay.
But
he does use it. I know he writes somewhere in the 50s. He uses the phrase cultural relativism, or he deals with that charge that he is a cultural relativist. Do you recall that? Somewhere he takes that on.
I vaguely have a recollection about some discussion of that, but I can't remember exactly what he's doing or how he's handling it.
Okay, well, in one of the early essays, maybe Explorations 1, he talks about we're not going to resolve the competing claims of all the cultures around the world of their value system or perception advantage versus other cultures. Remember he said, we're never going to resolve that, even though we what?
That's not because, for one thing, McLuhan isn't interested in what might be called an absolute point of view.
Yes.
Okay, number one. Number two, what's much more interesting to me is the idea that in order to think about cultures rationally and in such a way that science results, they must be taken relatively, right? So this gets into Einstein, and we live in a time of advanced nihilism. If everybody thinks that everything's relative and everybody's got a point of view and either that's okay or it's not okay or whatever. So there's this sort of cloud of nihilism that happens.
Yeah, why
over.
Do you call that nihilism?
It hangs on the idea that nothing is true.
Oh, okay.
That there is no way of advancing to a common truth about these things.
Yes.
And for what's interesting about McLuhan, at least for me, is he says, yes, there is, but it hangs on relativity. So what most people regard as the death of truth, namely relativity, McLuhan agrees with Einstein that that's the key to truth.
Yes. Okay, so one more thought. In that where he talks about we're not going to be able to resolve the arguments and claims of different cultures and traditions and different phases of cultural history,
right.
He says we are in an environment of the instantaneity and perfection of communication.
Right.
You know, that's an interesting complement to the relativity issue. Now, when you say...
Oh, it's not a compliment. It's a
ground.
It's a result. It's how can I say that?
Well, it's a ground. I noticed you one of the quotes and when I read, he uses the term Esperanto with a capital E.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is what he has used it before, but it stands out there, and I've used it that way, but I don't think I remember that use in that sentence. But
what might interest you, Bob, is the idea of an Esperanto plays a big role in Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
Not Esperanto per se, but there were a whole series of sort of invented languages that started sometime back in the early 1800s, I think.
Yeah.
And have been brought forward. Joyce plays with these languages in the Wake.
I think one of them's called Volapuk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what's, to me at least, what's very interesting about that is that that was the brainchild of a pastor in Metzkirch, in Germany, in southern Germany. And Metzkirch is where Heidegger was born and is now buried.
Ah, okay. Now let's get into, what do you mean by relativity? Do you mean cultural juxtaposition, collage? Like, what is relativity as you're using it?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that relativity has to do with intelligibility. When a minute ago you were talking about something about the claims of different
cultures, yes,
cannot be resolved or something like that.
Yes.
So the interesting word there to me is the word resolve. What the hell does resolve mean? And what happens between the Gutenberg galaxy and the electric or mosaic galaxy for McLuhan is that how the word resolve is cached is undergoes radical change. If you think of a resolution in a microscope, where you have to adjust the microscope so that the image resolves into clarity, that's the sort of resolution that the Gutenberg galaxy fosters.
Yes.
But in the I'll call it the Mosaic or Einsteinian galaxy, what is wanted is a resolution that isn't clear and distinct, what you're trying to achieve with a microscope. Instead, it's dynamic. And one of the things that McLuhan found in the middle 50s and developed between then to Gutenberg galaxy is that theory that works is dynamic. It doesn't produce resolution in a way that I think he previously thought it did.
Yeah, it produces the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions.
Right.
And you know, someone, I was saying this on my show the other night, and they added, in space and time. Actually, that whole sentence ends with McLuhan saying, you know, the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions in space and time, I think. I do not add those words. Maybe I should. But now, what you were just saying, remember, you're calling it the Einsteinian or the Mosaic galaxy. Remember, McLuhan called it the Marconi galaxy.
Yeah, but this actually gets into an interesting question. I'm trying to write a post about it now, and it's very difficult. McLuhan, I don't think, ever resolved exactly what the difference is between pre-literacy, post-literacy, and what might be called hyper-experientiality. So, for example, in several places, he talks about people emerging from literate space into Einsteinian space.
Yes.
But there's a vast problem there, because when a culture has new sort of presuppositions and a kind of different feeling for what it means to be in the world, that can certainly be said to be Einsteinian in a certain sense relative to what used to be felt. And so oftentimes in this context, McLuhan will bring up Alice in Wonderland, and he'll say on one side of the mirror you have the old way of thinking about self and world, and then behind the mirror you have a completely different way, and he frequently will say that it's relative or Einsteinian or something. But that's problematic, because what he's doing there is he's running together three things that need to be differentiated. And two of the things that he needs to differentiate, namely pre-literal culture and post-literal culture, he did struggle with himself, and he tries to figure that out a number of times. And I think you yourself have talked about that in ways that I found interesting.
Yes.
In different places. But then, if you're talking about Einsteinian insight into the relativity of cultures, that's something else again, right? Because what if we talk about, we've got a pre-literal environment, we'll leave aside the idea the problem that the whole notion of environment is very unclear in McLuhan, but you've got a pre-literal environment, you've got a literal environment, you've got a post-literal environment, and then you've got a way of talking about all of this. And all of those are very different. And until they are properly distinguished and properly related, then you don't have much. And so McLuhan made a number of very important steps in the clarification of this whole nexus. But I think that especially the clarification of the difference between what might be called Marconian space and Einsteinian space
which are different. Those are different in the level, right? And Einstein is able to conceptualize, we could say, Marconian space along with other spaces in a way that finds its intelligibility in their mutual comprehension. And Marconian space could be said to be the simultaneity of all cultures, but not the comprehension of all cultures.
And you're saying Einstein does the comprehension more towards...
Yes. But remember, Einstein was a living, breathing guy, so he was in a Marconian environment and could be talked about that way, but he also had a theory about the Marconian environment that had to do with its relativity to other environments.
What do you think of McLuhan saying that E equals MC squared is almost not pictographic, it's sculptural? You've seen him say that, I think, in Gutenberg Galaxy. What do you make of that? He's trying to say something different. That may have been, you know, he says pictographic in 54, but you say he then gets more appreciation of the odd-owl tactile by the late 50s, and that's why he changed it to sculptural in Gutenberg Galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Could well be.
Yeah.
I like that idea. Yeah.
Okay, so back to the Einstein and relativity. So I'm not sure...
Let's just go back to the end of the 1950s and look at what he was trying to figure out.
Yeah.
By 54 or 55, he's still caught up in ways that he doesn't even understand in the visual environment. But by continually thinking about acoustic space, for the reasons that we were talking about before, he is starting to extricate himself from visual experience to an appreciation also of acoustic experience. So in order to theorize about experience as a whole, he is going to need to be able to value visual experience and acoustic experience. And in fact, he's going to have to be able to understand all sorts of different kind of subspecies of these mega types of experience. But he often runs together the type of experience that the theoretician of experience has with acoustic experience, which is only one variety of the whole range of experience.
Yes.
And I believe that just as McLuhan had to differentiate between visual and acoustic experience, and it was that that led him to the Gutenberg galaxy, and it was that that led him to a kind of typology of experience, and is his main contribution, so he also had to differentiate between, say, first-level Marconian experience and second-level theorization of that experience along with every other kind.
Yes.
And I think he was less successful in the latter.
Is he attempting that in the new science, in Laws of Media? Is Laws of Media not a successful book in the way you were just saying that he failed in the theorization?
Well, the Laws of Media is not his book, right? Laws of Media are a whole bunch of different notes that Eric was able to use and to make into a book. And Eric was absolutely right that it needed to be preserved, and he's recently given to the University of Toronto all of the different tapes and notes and things that went into the making of the book.
Yes,
which is very, very good. So I don't regard the Laws of Media as one thing. I regard it as a collection of things. And so I would reformulate your question. Is McLuhan grappling in any of those notes and tapes with the sort of question that I'm indicating?
Yes.
I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
But I don't, but I'm not aware, and, you know, there are many things I'm not aware of that I should be aware of, but I'm not aware of him being particularly successful in answering this question.
Right. Now, around the center, I remember this visual space essay, very, you know, many Xerox pages being sent out to John Cage and Carpenter and different people, and I got a copy of it. I think that is the visual space or Proteus, that chapter about visual space is was written by McLuhan and makes a big chunk, is a big section of Laws of Media.
Oh, sure. I didn't mean to say that Laws of Media were
just
largely words. I think it's largely Marshall's words, but it had to be put together from various things.
Right.
So, for example, there's a whole section of Laws of Media that comes out of McLuhan's comments when he and Eric Havelock did their talk on Innes in 78.
Yeah, I attended that. I witnessed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what he said that day is one section of Laws of Media.
Yes. Okay, so what is the point you're trying to... Have you spelled out how you're using relativity, or we haven't got to that point yet?
No, I've tried to. Did you look at the post? I sent you a link in an email about a... it was a link to a post I did in a couple of years ago where I kind of introduced this notion.
What was that called?
It was called The Beginnings of Gutenberg Galaxy 2.
Yeah, I think I read that.
It started with a letter to Carruthers.
Yes, yeah. Now, do you want to say something about that? Or you wait for a question? You want a question from me?
Well, I guess I would just say that we've been talking about this stuff as my latest writings or something, but it's something that I wrote about a couple of years ago, and that in other contexts I've written about like 10 years ago, and it's, if we think back to around 1999, on the forum that was hosted at Johns Hopkins, where we were both writing a bit, you mentioned that I was constantly talking about time and times, and that it wasn't comprehensible. That very much relates to what we're talking about now as well. So it's something that I've been dealing with for a very long time.
Yeah, you're talking about the Peter Montgomery list that Michael Edmonds took over. That's when, you know, you and I, you were posting a lot, and I was reading your responses in the late 90s. Why do you say Johns Hopkins?
Because that's where it's hosted, and it's still available, I believe. Last time I looked, it was still there.
Wait, this is the one called McLuhan L, the McLuhan L hyphen L list?
No, I don't know about that, Bob. All I know is that... Montgomery was posting a lot. Strait was posting a lot. You were there. Mark got kicked off at a certain point.
Oh, that's the Media Ecology list run by Lance Strait. Yeah. But we also had the Montgomery, Michael Edmonds list, and you posted a lot. But you know, what you were saying, it was quite consistent. You kept saying these points about the time and times, and my criticism was this is too conceptual. I think I have a better understanding of what you're doing now because I've read more about it. You were just posting it in these little paragraphs and seemed to be out of context almost. But I have a better understanding of what your point was back then by reading all these posts that you've laid out. You know, now
right.
I can see more material.
But also, Bob, you're ceasing to see it in the rearview mirror.
What, you're commenting on my perceptual evolution?
Well, I mean... anything that's worth thinking about is worth thinking about new.
Yes, yeah.
Right? So if you say, well, that's too conceptual or something like that, well, that's classifying in a certain way, and then once you've classified in a certain way, you don't have to bother about it anymore. Right? So
I think what I recall is my point was that you're writing up these things about the concept of time and time and times and other points, and what about the blatant erasure that we evolve a million years, which is what McLuhan said radio caused. Radio meant we instantly evolved, changed a million years worth of evolution. Have you ever seen that statement?
No, but it brings a, I've seen statements like that, let's say,
yes,
many times. But you have to remember, Bob, that you yourself, for example, in your conversation with Tom Wolfe, make the point that McLuhan is not about one environment.
Yes.
He's about multi-environments. So
that's what you meant. You're saying that's what you meant by time and times.
Well, I mean, it's. I'm simply saying that. How can I put this?
It's all right.
Thoughtful here, but or at least attempting to be thoughtful. I may not actually succeed.
Yeah,
but
you're attempting to be what? What are you saying? Facile? What's the word?
Thoughtful.
Thoughtful. Yeah, no. Take the. It's like you're stuttering. It's very involving as we watch you handle your own silence of thoughtfulness. So it's not not bad.
Great. I'll buy that. When you brought up the point about radio destroying a million years of evolution, the process of that and the end result of that is not everything that there is. That is one space.
That yeah.
is one environment that, according to McLuhan, and this idea comes from Einstein, if we want to think intelligently about these things, we have to think about them relatively. And that means we have to think about the different possibilities together in their...
This is what you mean by plural. When you talk about Einsteinian relativity, that's what you mean when you go plural. You write this.
Absolutely.
I see.
And notice how this is a fundamental part of what Wright was talking about. Perhaps not entirely consciously, but when Wright was saying that there are fundamental types, different types of experience, and when those are enough communication with each other that we can research them intelligently, he's saying that plurality is necessary to intelligibility.
Yeah, and isn't also McLuhan saying if we turned off the electric environment, really went on a media fast, we would not require plurality because our environment, which would be a print-dominated environment, if we just went back to the hot phase of the Gutenberg galaxy, would that mean that plurality would not become attractive as it did in the 20th century all through art and science and politics and everything? You see what I'm saying? The medium determined that new preference or new requirement. Isn't that McLuhan's main point?
Well, I would say that it's distinctive about our conversation that you like to talk about what I call figures. And I like to talk about ground.
and I say that what I talk about is ground, and you talk about figures. That's funny. We're doing Tweedledum, Tweedledee here.
Maybe. Nothing wrong with that.
No. Okay. So let's try to figure I wanted to say something. Have you ever read William Irwin Thompson?
Oh, only bits and pieces.
Yeah, well, he tries to, he coined the phrase cultural ecology because he thought he'd be limited just doing media ecology the way McLuhan did it. And he was a good student of McLuhan. He met McLuhan and read him and all this. But he says that there's five phases. The arithmetic mentality, which is what he calls the riverine civilization, Sumeria, Egypt. And then there's the geometrical mentality. That's the time of temple building, you know, the time of Christ, say. And then there's the algebraic mentality, which comes in 1000 A.D. with the abstraction of elaborate esoteric codes and the Islamic architectural developments in the Gothic cathedrals. So that's the algebraic mentality. And then in the print era, you bring in the Galilean dynamical mentality. And then the 20th century is complex dynamical mentality or chaos dynamical mentality. So he's got five phases. And he provides a lot more cultural scanning, x-raying across the world of what was going on in each phase, maybe more so than McLuhan. So someday I'd like to see if whatever you find inadequate in McLuhan, is Thompson solving that by his cultural ecology? He includes McLuhan, but he includes, you could say, a lot of content features.
But to me, first off, that seems very reminiscent of Spengler to me.
Okay.
Spengler was the big guy of Northrop Frye, right?
Yes.
So that, to me, what you were talking about in Thompson, I admit I know nothing about Thompson, so I'm not making a point about him.
Yes.
But what you said about Thompson, to me, misses the contribution of McLuhan. Because let's say that there are five mentalities.
Yes.
To me, the interesting question is, what enables us to identify each of these five as a mentality? And when we do that, when we identify our identification markers like that, how do these relate to each other? And according to McLuhan, as far as I read them, intelligibility comes from this kind of theory. Right? You have the...
What kind of theory?
The kind of theory I just identified, where you say what's common to these mentalities, what allows their identification as mentalities is X, Y, Z. And then... say, now what is it about X, Y, and Z that changes, that's variable in order that these mentalities that we identify as mentalities, we also identify them as different?
So you're saying, it sounds like you're saying that what Thompson does is valuable, but you actually mean the opposite, but you're not making it clear. Isn't that what you're just doing? Aren't you pointing out that McLuhan dealt with the eternals, the eternal verity, the eternal process of perception, the drama of cognition, so would not be subject to different phases of humanity and then the drop? Wouldn't you say McLuhan includes all mentalities that had been created are part of the dialogue? Is that what you're saying?
Let me just emphasize that I'm not talking about Thompson because I don't know enough about him.
Yeah.
I'm just taking off from what you were saying.
Yes.
But if we think about, let's think about chemical elements or something. If somebody says that the intelligibility of chemistry comes from Mendeleev's table and the laws of valence that are incorporated in that table. And then somebody else says, so this doesn't have anything to do with how fire works or something like that. It would be nonsense, right? It's that the whole idea of chemistry is that we can at last explain fire, but because we have these rules of how to look at fire. And what I'm saying is that McLuhan's contribution is that he gives us rules about how to look or how to test or how to hear or how to experience things that allows us to understand.
All right, now relate that to the concept of relativity. I grant you what you said. Now, why would you write about relativity in relation to those rules?
Right. So the reason that the way that chemistry works is that it takes physical materials and it says that none of these things are absolute. They are relative to each other through covariance. So there are electrons, protons, and neutrons that exist in a recognizable structure, and it's that structure which allows us to look at all materials, but those materials are different from each other because of the variations that are possible in that single structure.
And you're saying what you just said applies to the discipline of media.
Correct. Well, not just the discipline of media. It applies to all human experience.
So the chemistry doesn't?
No, of course chemistry doesn't apply to human experience, are you asking?
Yeah, does chemistry apply to all human experience?
Of course it does, but it applies in a different way. Right? When we're talking, something chemical is going on in our bodies at all times, in our brains at all times, in the air around us. This chemistry is going. If there were anything going on that weren't chemical, then there would be something wrong with chemistry. The way that chemistry works is that it applies to everything.
Right, and right? Chemistry is media.
No. The chemistry applies to everything, but everything is not only chemistry.
But
it's like your five bodies or six
yes,
bodies,
yeah.
Or however many you have to.
You don't need to go into it. Let me just say that the chemistry, McLuhan said, all knowledge, all ideas, all media, all technologies are media, everything we make. So we make chemistry. That's a collection of information. Wouldn't that be a medium, the medium of chemistry?
Sure. You could say that. Media are made.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm trying to think of a good way to put this. Let me just back up for a minute. Let's say that all physical materials are relative in the way we were just saying. And at least in my reading of McLuhan, what he's saying is all human experience is relative in the same way in that it has a common structure. That common structure is just as all physical materials are electrons, protons, and neutrons in very, very complicated ways and in ways that can combine with each other, so is human experience some variety of a relationship between visuality and the acoustic as modulated by tactility.
Mm.
And by understanding human experience in these terms, McLuhan says that
those are rules.
These are rules that allow the complete set of experience, all of it relative to the rest, to be intelligently investigated.
Right. You said the complete seven. What was that phrase? The complete set.
Set.
S-E-T? S-E-T.
S-E-T.
Yeah, okay. So,
yeah.
All right. So is media a broader category than chemistry?
It's just a different one.
All right. It's not necessarily broader.
I don't think that's a spatial. Broad is a spatial term.
Yeah.
That doesn't apply here.
Okay. So McLuhan created a new field of knowledge?
Well, he contributed to the potential birth of not only a new field, but new fields, plural.
Yes.
But he didn't, it certainly didn't eventuate from his work. I'd like to think that it might be latent in his work and it might develop, but I don't see many signs that people understand relativity as leading to intelligibility, unfortunately.
All right. Why wouldn't you include the kinesthetic or kinetic and proprioceptive in the trinity of eye, ear, and tactility?
Because he runs those together with tactility.
Right. He did say we only have four senses. Remember that?
I think you can find almost anything that McLuhan said. So we can't use that as proof of anything.
Yeah, you can't.
I'm sure you can.
Yeah, you can't say once he talks about five senses in the 50s, but in the late 70s he talks about we have four senses. You can't say either one. Let me say this. You can't, see if you agree with this. You can't say that either statement swallows up the other statement. They're both fragments evoked by a time.
Hey, sure. If people want to come down on a single thing that McLuhan said in a single place, single time, that's like some religious sect saying that this particular statement in the Bible is the only important one.
Right.
You can, as people always say, you can find anything in the Bible, and you can find anything in McLuhan.
Yeah, listen to this. I got this idea from just what you said. When people complain about fundamentalists in religion, take the Bible literal, and then a guy like maybe Bruce Powell would come on and say, no, you don't take Scripture as literal. You're pointing out that Scriptural is a multi-leveled agon of dialogue and perception, multi-times, and the literal interpretation is just one biased view, not biased as stupidity. It is a particular visually biased aspect. You can take the Bible literally if you know you're doing it literally with a visual bias, but there's other dynamics in philosophy and maybe theology that you're pointing out, right?
Yeah. Your example, I think, is an interesting one, and I can illustrate what I'm trying to say about relativity and topology in terms of this. Let's imagine that...
Now, define topology for the listener, because they don't know that word.
Okay, so topology is a branch of mathematics that studies the constants in a surface through all of the ways in which the surface can be manipulated.
Right.
As long as it's not torn.
Yeah, there's a constancy. Is hydrogen a constant? Is oxygen a constant in that sense?
No.
Okay.
No. The constants in topology, in a topological analysis, the constants are things that can be shown to hold true despite certain manipulations of the surface. That's all.
Now, relate that to McLuhan, maybe a concept of McLuhan that has that characteristic.
Well, instead of what McLuhan says is the single point of view is typical of Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah.
The single point of view is valuable in all sorts of ways, because you can look at a certain disease, and you can look at certain causes of that disease, and you can teach students about those causes and the disease, and they can conceivably cure it or ameliorate it. But there are all sorts of other ways in which people experience the world. So if you have a mosaic from the Middle Ages, let's say, there may be no perspective that does justice to that mosaic. You may have to look at it in a variety of ways. And then he says, well, if we don't absolutize any point of view and allow all points of view relative merit, is it still possible to conceptualize them? Is it still possible to know something about them?
Yeah, are you saying, is it still possible that there's a constant?
Or I would, instead of a constant, let's say a constancy.
Yeah.
Because if you think of chemistry, if you think of the elementary structure in chemistry, that is dynamic. The electrons are whirling around. There's all sorts of laws being expressed between the elementary particles. Right? So it's constancy. The constancy of the chemical element is not the same thing as something being constant that's fixed in place somewhere.
Right.
It's a constancy that's defined in terms of chemical theory.
Okay, so in media theory or media studies, is the constant, McLuhan's idea that all technologies are words, is that the constant?
No, the constant is the relationship between the visual, the acoustic, and the modulating role of the tactile.
Right, the shifting, the constant, and visual man would not come up with that, but electric man can see, and maybe pre-literate man can see the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. The process, the figure-ground interplay, is what you just said, is the constant. That's the constant.
Except that what you did just now is you introduced exactly the confusion that I said McLuhan had to work at, because it's the topological understanding of the constants of experience is certainly nothing that preliterate man ever did or ever could experience, and it's also nothing that Marconian man can experience. It's something that is more comprehensive than any one experience, regardless if that experience is preliterate or Marconian.
Right. It's more comprehensive.
Absolutely.
Times are happening. So
correct.
Is
all times. Right.
Is that a statement of constancy when I go all times are happening?
Sure. I mean, that's you could it is one of the constants of human experience is that all possibilities of experience are always open to it.
Right.
Right. It's not a very enlightening thing. That's like saying it's a property of all chemical elements to be an element. Yeah. Okay. Big deal. Right?
Yes.
But let me try to, I mean, all of this is very, very practical. Let's just take an example that comes out of something you were talking about a minute ago.
Yes.
With the Bible. Let's say McLuhan goes to the Catholic Church and he says, look, you guys are constantly trying to promote a certain experience of God, certain experience of Christ, a certain experience of the church. right? And McLuhan then says, look, I think that you're going to do much better if you let this stuff go. Allow all experience of anything to be relative. Nothing has to be absolute. Not the experience of God, not the experience of the church, not the experience of Christ. So then the church says, well, how can we be Christian anymore? And McLuhan says, well, let me tell you how. He says, people are reading the Bible, and there, some people are reading the Bible in a very sophisticated way, and some people are reading it in some sort of literal way and coming up with all sorts of absurd conclusions that the church doesn't want to endorse. By talking about relativity, you're not endorsing any of those absurd readings any more than you're absolutizing your own. So then the church says, well, okay, how then, what does it mean to be a church? And McLuhan would say, okay, let's say that we look at the type of experience that is reading the Bible in every conceivable way. And I will give you the structures to look at that will allow you to identify those structures and to compare them. Okay, so the church says, fine, let's do the experiment. So the Bible is taken as an example, as an experiment. And all of the ways of looking at the Bible are extricated using McLuhan's markers. And now McLuhan says, okay, now just as we had analyzed some piece of physical material and had taken out and had understood all of the elements that are involved in that, and once we understand the elements, we can understand how it works. Now we can begin to look at what the properties are, what the effects are, as he would say, of these different put-ons,
yeah,
all of these different interpretations, all these different experiences of the Bible.
Yeah.
And once we look at everything in this relative way, what we're going to find is that most of them turn out to be contradictory, or they have effects that they have no idea about when they're being exercised, but once they're clarified, they don't want to have them anymore. Because now, all of a sudden, they can understand effects before the cause, right? Because before, what they were doing...
Before the what? Before the what? The
cause.
Say it again?
Before the cause. Just... The cause, Bob.
C-A-U-S-E, before the cause.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what McLuhan wants to do is, just as if we have a chemical element, we know what its valence is, what its properties are, and all that sort of stuff, and we can use it because we know its effects. We don't have to bother to go through causing those effects, right?
Yeah.
And so McLuhan says this is the same thing with how we want to look at the Bible. We want to identify what the effects are of all of these different experiences. And then we want to say, once we know these effects, how many of these ways of experiencing do we want to exercise?
Yes.
And what he says to the Catholic Church is, look, if you guys are right that this is the best way to read the Bible, that this is the best way to have a church, that this is the best way to look at God, that will demonstrate itself from the study of these effects.
Right.
And so what he does is he says, in relativity is not something to be feared by an organization like the church. It's the very way in which it can demonstrate and practice its claims.
Yeah, it makes me think of how the world will never stop talking and dialogue, communicating is not a finite conclusion. This communication part is like the closest to what living, if we define living, what's living? It seems to be this constant exchange of words with maybe newer patterns being added to it. Do you think that's what you're saying?
Well, I think that that is one aspect of what I'm saying, in the sense that once a field is identified for investigation, as we see in chemistry, or physics, or any, or biology, or genetics, identifying a new field isn't an act of closure, it's an act of opening.
Yes.
So before we were talking about the full set, but identifying what a set is an open question, right? For example, people are still to this day identifying new elements in chemistry. That doesn't upset chemistry, it's what chemistry is.
Yeah, did you know McLuhan used to say, he said it several times in the seminars, that the word set is the longest entry in the Oxford Dictionary.
Well, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, S-E-T. Mm-hmm. Like it's endlessly trying to figure out what it means, I guess. Many proposals about what it means has the longest entry. But back, so, yes, so you were saying, do you want to finish what you're saying? Did you finish it relatively?
No, I mean, I can talk about this forever, so it doesn't matter to me where I stop.
Oh, okay. So I want to, since you got to go any minute, because it's quarter after 8 your time. I think you have to go by then. So you find there's not a book on McLuhan, a scholarly book or whatever, that even begins to say what you're pointing out.
Not that I know of, no.
So they're being fundamentalists or literalists. They're not understanding the dialogic open-endedness of media studies, as McLuhan lays out.
My way of thinking, yeah, that's right. That they ultimately they privilege one or more points of view that make McLuhan's attempt to investigate all points of view impossible.
Yeah, right. Now, would you say that the way Finnegan's Wake is laid out, that is the best visualization in book terms of what McLuhan was about?
Well, I wouldn't say the best. I would just say a way.
Is there another bunch of ways? What would be other good illustrations of that, of what you're saying?
Well, what I'm trying to do in my blog or
yeah.
I mean, in the best of all cases, it would be the new sciences, plural, that get generated out of this.
Yes.
I mean, our knowledge of human experience is just pathetic, right? We don't even, if you compare it to the physical sciences, right, is the experience that I'm having right now and that you are having right now, is that like the water that is fitting in a glass, so it's relatively simple combination of hydrogen and oxygen and maybe a few impurities or something? Or is it like a piece of earth outside the door that's got all kinds of compounds and elements and mixtures in that lump, and it would be very difficult to analyze? Or is it like a weather pattern, which has just incredible complications going on? Everything that's going on is still chemical, but it's unbelievably complicated. So that even the most powerful computers we have at the present time only can do approximations of weather patterns. So we don't even know how to address the rough level of what human experience is, let alone when you have different experiences put together like yours and mine just now, or mine within this neighborhood, or within the country, or, right? So we're very, very primitive when it comes to thinking.
This is a good question to open our next dialogue in a month or two, whenever you get back. But so what was I going to say about that? The isn't today the way people, the media, the multimedial experiences we have, isn't the range of expressiveness close to the complexity of human experience you're trying to say? It's an externalization of the complexity of human experience is our multimedia world. Hey?
No, Bob, I mean, this is, I've actually talked about this in different ways many times in our conversation. There's a vast difference. There's an infinite difference. There's a gap difference, a fundamental difference between a weather pattern and its conceptualization.
Yeah.
You're talking about, when you're talking about what's going on with all of this hubbub, that's like a weather pattern.
Yes.
But its conceptualization is something completely different. It's not that the conceptualization is clear or easy or simple or static or constant or any of those things. In fact, it's if we try to conceptualize a weather pattern, that's something that we can begin to do, but we can't do it to the end. It's going to go on. Once we start, that's going to go on forever, and our understanding is going to get more complicated and all that sort of stuff, right? But differentiating between the two, the literal or figurative weather pattern and the grounding laws that are being expressed in that weather pattern, those are completely different things.
Mm.
And we're only going to get to the laws by making that clear differentiation.
Right. So I don't know if I can remember what I was going to say. Wouldn't all the different kinds of McLuhan scholarship, because they're usually books, and the book's such a limiting point, limiting medium, that one could enjoy all the different kinds of scholarship, that would be a better approach than trying to find out which one is correct? Aren't you promoting a variety of tolerance?
Oh, absolutely. But it's not... the fault of McLuhan scholarship is that people try to find a ground or a set of grounds or something like that instead of turning to relativity.
You say that's not a fault. That's not a fault. Or did you say it was a fault?
Well, all human beings all the time have faults. It's just that relativity has different kinds of faults from the faults that most writing on McLuhan had.
Right. So what's an example of relativity?
Atom bombs, going to the moon, our understanding of the universe, computers, all of that stuff depends upon the theory of relativity.
Do you mean, is relativity an inventory?
No, relativity is a theory about covariability.
And how many people have uttered it? How many different fields have come up with that?
Well, but come up with or utilize?
Utilize it.
Oh, the whole modern world is based on the scientific world was changed by Einstein and by related insight into relativity. And so material science and computer science and all of these things are possible on new understanding of what intelligibility is. And in my understanding of McLuhan, and of course my understanding of McLuhan could be completely wrong, right? My my fallacy is...
it's completely wrong.
That's right. So, you know, once we distinguish between the expression of relativity and the formulation of the initial formulation of relativity, then the expression of relativity is sort of everything that we see.
Well, is there a new thinking that goes that Einstein did not include, and maybe that was McLuhan doing it? Is there something that you would update from science or some study? Some movement?
Yeah, sure. But in this, that's where we started, Bob. We started by talking about Joyce and Einstein.
Yes.
It's not a question of updating. Updating is something that belongs to the Gutenberg galaxy and to lineality.
Yeah.
What's going on here is the application of the same theory to a new domain, and that the new domain is experience. But when the old theory, namely the theory of relativity, is applied to it, the theory itself may change, right? The theory of relativity, as formulated by Einstein, that is itself an example of complex experience, and so that falls within the new domain.
Yeah.
And so the articulation of this new domain may go back to Einstein or go back to Liddell with Alice in Wonderland, as McLuhan would always say. Alice anticipated
Einstein
by 40 years.
Right. No, I get that. Let me end by saying this. When I say that modern human beings today are not tribal, and then I bring in the fact that our media environments allow a greater degree of autonomy compared to any cultural consensus, belief systems or whatever, and so when I say that mass man is tribal plus autonomy overlaid maybe quadriphenically, is that what you find interesting in what I said about our time?
I find that I find it an interesting statement in the sense that it suggests a certain problem.
Yes.
And the problem is that on the one hand, it's a type of experience that includes a whole bunch of other types of experience.
Yes.
So it suggests a third thing, and that third thing would be one type of experience, which includes a whole bunch of other types of experience, but instead of being chaotic, it would be rule-governed.
Ah, very good. I think, because you did say, you know, an hour or two ago, you found something interesting, some of the things I say interesting. I wonder if that idea was what it was. So you are partly agreeing.
No, that's what I mean. I find, first off, you have a great sense of humor, about many things, including yourself.
Yes.
And I find your conversation on practically anything interesting. But in terms of McLuhan, what's interesting about what you say is that you don't try to reduce it.
Yeah.
To something. And reduction, especially to a single point of view or a certain doctrine or a certain time, is the great failure of most McLuhan scholarship.
Right. Okay, Cameron, that's a great conversation again. I really enjoy our talks. I hope we'll do some more when you come back from your break. And, you know, kudos to you for highlighting quotations of Marshall that no one else really knew happened or even read. It's really good, your inventory of what you're putting together. So keep it going, man. It's really good.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again, Cameron, and we'll talk soon.